Thanks for the introduction, and want to thank everybody for doing such a great job of organizing and supporting our visit today. I'm going to kick things off with some a brief set of remarks, and then we'll turn to questions that were submitted beforehand. And also, as you'll see, we have an opportunity for you to ask questions during the course of the event as well. So I'm going to kick things off with some basics about the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. And I'll say a few words about my current thinking about monetary policy as well. But really, the plan is for us to spend the bulk of the evening on your questions. But I want to emphasize one thing before I start, and it's really important for you to keep it in mind throughout the evening. The views I'm going to express today are my own and not necessarily those of others in the Federal Reserve System, including my colleagues on the Federal Open Market Committee that make monetary policy with me. So I'm going to be speaking for myself and not for anybody else. So in terms of basics about the Fed, I like to tell the people that the Fed is a uniquely American institution. So what do I mean when I say that? Well, if you look around the world, at all the central banks around the world, the U.S. central bank really stands out as being highly decentralized. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is one of 12 regional reserve banks that, along with the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., make up the Federal Reserve System. So our bank serves as the headquarters for Federal Reserve System operations in the ninth of the 12 Federal Reserve districts. And that district includes the states of the North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, parts of Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Now, 8 times per year, the Federal Open Market Committee meets to determine the appropriate stance of monetary policy. So I'm not going to get into too many details right now about what I mean by stance of monetary policy. We'll call on Scott later to carry that for us. No, I'm sure we'll get into that later, and I'll be happy to explain that more. All 12 presidents of the various regional Federal Reserve banks, including me, and the governors of the Federal Reserve Board contribute to these deliberations. But the committee itself consists only of the governors, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a rotating group of 4 other presidents. So all 12 of the presidents and the five governors are in there contributing to the making of policy. But the people who actually vote on policy are the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the 5 governors, and a rotating group of 4 other presidents. Last year, I was one of the voters on monetary policy. This year, I've rotated off that role. Now, the reason that I think this is really uniquely American is because of how it mirrors a federalist structure of our government. We've got representatives from different regions of the country, the various presidents having input into FOMC deliberations. Now, as I've said at its meetings, the FOMC determines the appropriate stance of monetary policy. And we'll talk, I'm sure, about what stance of monetary policy means later. But let me say a few words about what the word appropriate means. What are we trying to achieve through our monetary policy choices? So Congress has told us what to do. You know, the Federal Reserve is a creation of Congress through legislation passed by Congress. And they've told us what we're supposed to be doing when we make monetary policy. To achieve 2 objectives: promote price stability and to promote maximum employment. And we've interpreted that first goal, that verbal goal of price stability, to mean keeping inflation close to 2%. Now, in order to meet these 2 objectives, promoting price stability and promoting maximum employment, the FOMC is targeting a Fed funds rate, which is a short-term interbank lending rate, near zero for over 6 years, since December 2008. There's been a lot of conversation recently about the desirability of initiating a gradual increase in the Fed funds rate sometime in this calendar year, in 2015. So how should we decide about the desirability of such a move? So in my view, I think the right way to think about the desirability of such a policy decision is through the lens of our goals, through the lens of our objectives. Would it help further our being able to achieve our goals? Well, let's look at where we are in terms of inflation. So right now, personal consumption expenditure inflation, PC inflation, is running well below 2%. And my current outlook is that it will continue to do so for several years. So if you just look at prices alone, raising the Fed funds in 2015 would be inappropriate. Because we're below target right now in terms of inflation, raising the Fed funds rate would slow down economic activity and further delay the return of inflation to our 2% objective. So that's on the price dimension. The other goal we have is to promote max employment. And the labor market improved rapidly in 2014. It was a very good year for the labor market. But that one good year does not make up for several preceding disappointing ones. Really going back to 2008, we've had six disappointing years before that and one good year in 2014. The FOMC can best fulfill its congressional mandate of promoting max employment by doing what it can to facilitate further labor market improvement like we saw in 2014. Why stop with just 2014? We should have more years like 2014. Again, this consideration argues against raising the Fed funds rate in 2015. So based on my current economic outlook for prices and for employment, the FOMC can best achieve its objectives by keeping the Fed funds rate target at its current level during this calendar year. A very important part of my message here, though, is that this conclusion is fundamentally an optimistic one. The data on inflation and employment show us that we could produce more and consume more as a country by utilizing more of our available human resources. Monetary policy can and should be used to make the desirable outcome happen. Thank you very much for listening, and now I look forward to taking your questions.
So we want to point out, if we go to the first question, at the bottom of that slide, you'll see a phone number and you'll see a hashtag. And if any of you have any questions during our conversation that you'd like to have asked, text it to that number or send it to that hashtag and we'll check in the back of the room and see if anything's been received. We have built some of your questions in already to what we're about to ask here. So, Narayana, as a first question, what is your response to those who criticize quantitative easing too as merely encouraging a bubble in asset prices?
So let me give some context. Very good question. Let me give some context about what we mean by quantitative easing. As I just mentioned, the Federal Open Market Committee faced a problem beginning in December 2008. So in the early part of 2009, the economy was doing extremely poorly. We had extreme number of job losses every month. In the usual way that monetary policy would try to combat that kind of undesirable outcome would be to stimulate the economy by lowering interest rates, by lowering the target range for the Fed funds rate that I just talked about. But it had already lowered it basically as far as it could at the end of 2008. So the committee turned to alternative tools really even at the end of 2008, but then throughout 2009, which was to buy, not just set the short-term interbank lending rate, as I was talking about earlier, but to try to put downward pressure on longer-term interest rates as well by buying long-term assets. Primarily, these would be assets that were issued by the federal government or backed by the federal government. Long-term bonds are also mortgage-backed securities that were issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which since the end of 2008 has basically been backed by the federal government. So what has been the effect of this policy? An enormous number of assets have been bought. We're now over $4 trillion on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet at this point in the form of these longer-term assets. And so what's been the impact of this policy? Basically, it's to put downward pressure on long-term interest rates. This has been, provided upward stimulus to the economy in terms of supporting demand for consumption. When interest rates are low, what happens is people think to themselves, it's easier to borrow because interest rates are lower, and it's less tempting to save because interest rates are lower. That stimulates spending both by consumers and households and by firms. That puts upward pressure on both prices and employment. It also puts upward pressure on asset prices. So when interest rates are low, long-term assets like bonds and mortgage-backed securities more expensive, one of the effects of that is that it inclines people to be more to buy more stocks, driving up the prices of stocks, and also to buy more housing, driving up the prices of housing. I think those effects are real and they're helpful for the economy. If people have more wealth in terms of stocks, that stimulates more spending. If they have more wealth in their housing, that also stimulate spending. This is all part of the way policy is supposed to work. Now, I think the word that I would object to here is the word bubble. I don't think that you look at asset prices now, I think it's very hard to see the kind of instability in asset prices. I don't see it in asset prices right now as something indicating a bubble. Perhaps more importantly, we keep track of how investors are thinking about uncertainty in asset price movements through by looking at other asset prices, how financial markets are trying to think about risks. And we don't see any untoward risks about sharp downward movements being priced into stock prices, for example. So I think we've encouraged, certainly the quantitative easing programs have stimulated the economy, pushed upward on asset prices, but this has all been positive. Think basically means prices and employment would have been lower had we not done this, which I think is true.
Thank you. Do you think the lack of rising wages in the United States is going to have a harmful deflationary effect on our economy?
So now I'm going to get all technical. I think it's a very good question, but I'm going to parse between two words. One is deflationary, and the other is disinflationary. So by deflationary, and economists use that, they're talking about having inflation turn negative, actually having prices fall over time. I see the risk of that as being very low in the United States. Will it have a disinflationary effect on the economy? That I'm more worried about. So we want to try to keep inflation close to 2%. That's one of our objectives. Having wages as low as they are, having the lack of basically what this is telling us, the lack of rising wages is telling us is that there's a lot of people available to work, a lot of human resources available, and we're not running up against scarcity and constraints in that. Otherwise, we'd see rising wages. The fact we don't see that means that it can lead people and firms to not push forward price increases and lead people not to think there's going to be price increases coming. All this pushes down on inflation. So I do think that the lack of wage pressure could generate disinflation. That is, inflation continuing to run below 2% or even falling further below our target. I think the risk of actually hearing deflation where prices are falling, negative inflation, is quite unlikely.
Any thoughts about deflation or disinflation in Europe, in Asia, and how that might affect the U.S. economy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons that we worry about this as economists is that you see what's happened in Japan over the past 20 years. Beginning in the mid-90s, the Japanese had a very sharp downward fall in housing prices the early part of the 90s. And they also lowered interest rates in an attempt to bolster the economy. But essentially, inflationary pressures and wage inflation pressures kept falling in Japan. And they've gotten stuck in a deflationary pattern for many years. Recently, last couple years, they've tried through both fiscal policy and monetary policy to use stimulative policy to try to push upward on inflation and inflation expectations. But they continue to face challenges on that. Inflation remains very low in Japan, pretty close to zero. And in Europe, I think they face a challenging situation. Inflation is well below what their target is. And they've seen a slide in inflation. And also in what we call market-based measures of inflation expectations. These are essentially the bets that financial market participants are placing on where inflation is going to go in the future. In Europe, though, you see they're betting that inflation is going to be low. It's the same effect has happened here in the United States. The good news is it hasn't happened to the same extent. We've also seen a slide where market participants think inflation is going to go. But these are problems that are, the challenge is once inflation and inflation expectations fall and get stuck in a low level, it seems to have proven to be, for countries like Japan and for the European Central Bank, now Sweden is trying to figure out how to do this. How do you get them back up? It seems to be very hard. So we don't want to get in that situation, that's for sure.
So I'm going to check in with the back of the room. Got anything?
Yes, we do, and I'm on. Thanks for the questions. Keep them coming. Narayana, how does the rural nature of the 9th District impact your input on Fed policy?
Yeah, it's a good question. So first of all, one of the things I was really, I came to this job as described as an academic, as teaching the University of Minnesota. And One of the things you learn quickly about the 9th District, and you describe its spread and its sprawl, is that it's not as rural as you'd think. You know, a lot of the economy is actually pretty well diversified, like the U.S. economy. Certainly, agriculture plays a bigger role in a state like North Dakota or South Dakota than it does in the nation as a whole. But Minnesota is actually the kind of mix of activities across services and manufacturing and agriculture very representative of the nation as a whole. So you're not, it's not that different. With that said, I do feel called upon to, as a president, to talk to my FOMC colleagues about what we see happening in terms of the impact of changes in commodity prices on the residents of the 9th District, changes in agricultural land prices on the 9th District. But frankly, agriculture is a relatively small part of the nation's economy. You know, we're certainly in the single digits of the percent of contribution of GDP, probably the low single digits, in fact. It's a little higher than that for the 9th District, but not enormously so. So it's not going to play a big role in actually the kind, you heard how I talked about policy. I'm talking about the national economy, talking about how to, the outlook for national variables. What's happening in terms of the rural side of the 9th District is not going to play that big a role in that.
So please keep your questions coming in. Yep. We'll check back in several times during the conversation and see what else is on your mind. So we've talked about the map, and we've talked about how the car is doing on its journey. Let's pop the hood and look underneath and ask a couple questions that are on some of the minds out there about the dynamics of the FOMC.
Ah,
so first, can you talk about the interpersonal dynamics during an FOMC meeting? Is there lively discussion going on? Is it understated interaction? What does it actually feel like to be in the room and have these discussions?
So the first thing I'll say is, so this is a, I don't want to get into too much detail, but it's a beautiful room you're in. You're the boardroom of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. It's an enormous table, which fits the 17 of us and a large number of staff as well to help us with our deliberations. So you just, the first thing you feel when you walk into this room and you sit at this table is just an enormous sense of privilege. To have this role in your country's life is just, I mean, it's just amazing. And my colleagues, you know, you're just struck by the level of dedication that all these people bring to the task. And it's a very, I like the word, use the word technocratic. It's very objective, neutral kind of conversation. It's not about people staking out strong positions and trying to argue with each other along those lines. It is not a debating society. It is a situation where we're each asked in turn to speak about our views on the economy first. And actually, first will be a staff presentation, and then we all each speak in turn about our views on the economy. And then a staff presentation about what they see as the likely policy alternatives, the most attractive policy alternatives before the committee. And then we'll each speak in turn on those. I would say most participants, including myself, are very aware of the fact that a word-by-word transcript is released 5 years later. And so people come in with prepared remarks. And pretty much as I did this today, I'll read from a script. I think there's pluses and minuses from that. You know, monetary policy is something that isn't typically a short-term policy decision. Something that's affecting the economy with a lag of 18 to 24 months. There's no reason to get in the room and try to debate it out in a moment in time. So what happens is this gives rise to a slow motion debate. So I'll say something in March, and one of my colleagues will come back and say, you know, I checked this out with my staff. They've had the following things to say about it. You know, usually it's not like we totally agree with you, but it's rather, you know, here's the line, well, how we disagree with what you're saying. It's not an attempt to try to, Chairman Bernanke introduced the idea of what he called two-handed interventions. So what does that mean is after each person speaks, after a person's finished speaking, you can have the opportunity to say, in the midst of the meeting, have a contribution. That's not the standard way of interacting with the committee at all. It's really more this person-by-person contributions. With the chair summarizing at the end to try to bring a sense of harmony among all the disparate views. And then a meeting-by-meeting interchange as opposed to anything else. Where I will say that just an enormously collegial group. We get along very well. The presidents work together on as really administrators for the whole system. I mean, you have to be collegial in that interaction. I mean, there's no other way to be, as you would well know from your job. You have to be able to cooperate and collaborate in that role. And we get along very well in both spheres, I think. So it's been a very fun group to be a part of.
So then I think probably the flip side of that question is, given the privileged, you said, felt privileged to be there, and the kind of rarefied atmosphere that is, I'm going to the next question on the list here. How can members of the FMOC connect with the lives of real people? When you're in that room and it's this kind of very rarefied, slow motion debate, what can you do? What do you do? Well, you're doing something right now. You're here talking to us. But what can be done to stay connected to the lives of the people who are so affected by these decisions?
So, first step is, I think this is a challenge for us as monetary policymakers. I suspect it's a challenge for all policymakers. I think that, I talked about how recovery in employment's been very slow. One of the data points we just recently looked at was the fraction of people aged 25 to 54 who have a college degree and how that's behaved over the last 6 or 7 years. So this is the fraction of people aged 25 to 54. We're doing that to try to strip out the fact that so many people are getting to be retirement age. That's why we're looking at 25 to 54. And then we're looking at those people who have a college degree. If you just focused on that variable alone, you'd say we're back to sort of normal in terms of employment. It looks pretty much the same as it did in 2006. What does that point to? It points to you can't just talk to people with college degrees, right? Because you're not getting the full experience of what's going on in the United States. So we try to, speaking for myself, we try to reach out in a number of different ways. We talk to business leaders, but we also talk to community leaders to try to get a sense of some of the challenges that might be faced by workers as well as by employers. More generally, I try to talk to labor leaders as well as to business leaders to get sides from both sides of the bargaining table, as it were. But it is an ongoing challenge, I would say, absolutely.
So one of the things that the folks are struggling with is saving for retirement. We want folks to save for retirement, but interest rates are low, really low. So how do we reconcile that in terms of the low interest rate policy with long-term individual needs, saving for retirement, folks being able to look forward to a bright future?
I think it's a great question. And we're just in a world of low interest rates right now. And I think it's important to realize that this is not a creation of this particular FOMC alone. You can go around the world and look at interest rates different parts of the globe and look at really very long-term interest rates, and you'll see the same pattern of very low interest rates. And I like to spin it in terms of low interest rates are the same as high prices. So when interest rates are low, that's telling you that people are willing to pay a lot for getting stuff in the future relative to today. That's what low interest rates means. I think there's a temptation to think that we've created, that is the FOMC's created, that lower interest rate environment. But the fact of the matter is we're responding to that low interest rate environment just as much as the people that are describing this question. We're facing the challenge that we have to keep interest rates low in order to hit our objectives. Just like people saving for retirement are trying to hit their objectives by saving and finding it hard because interest rates are low, we're finding it hard to hit our objectives because the global interest rate environment is as low as it is. And our objective is being keeping inflation at 2% and employment at maximum. So what this is if you're in the world of trying to save for retirement, you look at Europe, people are aging. They have an even more of a demographic challenge than we do of more and more of their citizens getting to be older. China, the same thing is true. It's a very unusual situation in China, an emerging market, still relatively less developed than the United States in terms of per capita income, but also is facing demographic challenges of more and more people getting to retirement age. So all of this is, lots of people want to save. At the same time, a lot of financial institutions are being asked to hold a lot more safe assets. all of this is creating a demand for government bonds and long-term government bonds that is a challenge for individual savers, as being described here, because now you've got a bunch of other individuals around the world that are trying to do exactly the same thing you are. They're all trying to save. That's going to make it very expensive to save and make the yield on saving very low. That creates a challenge for us, too. In order to hit our objectives, we have to keep interest rates low.
So that tees up the next question beautifully. Are we going to hit 2% by 2018? If not, when are we going to hit 2%?
My benchmark outlook is that inflation will rise gradually back to 2% over the next 3 years. But we tend to focus a lot on our what we call our point forecasts. So I'm asked, where do you think inflation is going to be in 3 years? And I tell you, I think it's going to be at 2%. There's enormous uncertainty about that. And we don't talk much about that. Both upside, downside, lots of uncertainty. So it could take longer, but it could get there faster. Then as a policymaker, though, I also have to think about the risks. That am I more worried about the upside risk of inflation running above 2%? I'm more worried about the downside risk of inflation running below 2%. And I'm much more worried about the downside risk. And the reason, we talked about some of the reasons already, that we've seen in Europe and Japan, if inflation gets stuck at low levels, very hard to bring it back up. Especially, boy, our toolkit's not as full as we'd like it to be. We've had interest rates low for a long time. We've bought a lot of assets. So combating a situation where inflation was stayed lower than 2% for longer than 2018 would be a very challenging situation. And on the flip side, if it goes up too fast, if I turn out to be wrong in my forecast, we start seeing inflation pressures developing, we know how to, I'm not saying it would be a task that I would enjoy, but it's one that we can deal with. We know how to deal with it, which is that sign that we've got too much demand relative to supply. We want to constrain that demand by raising interest rates to encourage people to save as opposed to spend.
Thank you. Okay, let's go back and see what else is on the crowd's mind, please.
Well, take a break from policy for a moment, Marianne. We have a question about your work life. What does your average work day or work week look like? What's it like to be an Federal Reserve Bank president?
I think this is your question, Dave, isn't it?
No, it's not.
No, so I think that's a really hard question to answer because there's no average day. You just do a lot of different things. It's a great job in terms of how different it is from day to day. There are some days where I'm basically thinking, much as I did as an academic, about, boy, do we have the right models to try to tackle the questions we have before us? It's probably, my thinking is more focused on the question, policy questions than it used to be, but that's a typical day like an academic day. Some of the days are engaged, as I discuss, where I'll get together with my fellow presidents, or I'll be talking to other system leaders about how can we best manage the system, just a straight management job. And then there's the weeks surrounding the Federal Open Market Committee meetings, which are really all about planning for the policy decision. Then there are days like today, where we came out into Winona, we talked to first business leaders over lunch, talked to bankers, talked to community leaders, and now having the opportunity to take your questions. There's no average day, and that's what's fun about the job. There is no average day.
So when you were a student, like many of the students you see out here, I'm guessing you didn't dream you were going to be a Federal Reserve president. For the students, what sort of should they be thinking about if this is a pathway they want to pursue?
Oh, just be open to any opportunities that come along. Keep yourself flexible. Never feel like you're locked into anything. Be curious about what kinds of opportunities can come your way. Certainly when I was a student, I didn't think of my.
When you were 20, what did you think you were going to be doing?
I probably knew at that point I was going to be a professor of economics, but I wouldn't have thought of that as translating into a policy role. I was pretty serious in the academic side, and so I would have seen myself as continuing in that role. Frankly, even as recent, the thing that drove me into the policy sphere is much more what happened in terms of the crisis that hit the country. Is I just felt like I had done all this work and research and thinking about macroeconomic policy, I just thought I could be of service to my country at a time of need. If I had been, I would not have thought about doing this job in 2005, in 2009, because of the crisis. This is a time when I wanted to be of help and service. But you just want to, in terms of many, if you're 20 euros right now, you're going to do a lot of different things in your life. You're just going to learn a lot of new things. Just keeping yourself open and being flexible about how to approach those new opportunities is my advice, I guess.
So let me ask one more follow-up to that. So I hope you kind of heard that Narayana's time in the Fed started in 2009.
Yeah.
So you came in the midst of one of the largest economic challenges that any of us will ever know. What was that like? What was it like kind of coming into that role, knowing that that was a pretty steep hill to climb?
You know, it's as I said, I thought I had ideas and ways of thinking that could be of help. One of the great aspects of the Federal Open Market Committee in dealing with the policy challenges, it's a group effort, and it's a team effort, and you really feel like you're part of a group of people who are trying to work together to solve the very daunting problems that were on our plate. And, you know, and that team had a captain, and it was, you know, Chairman Bernanke was our captain. And so you don't feel like it's certainly a big responsibility, but it's not, your responsibility is to be an effective part of that team and working towards the goals that we have to achieve. And it's not that it's all on me by any means.
So bringing it kind of back to the question, these questions we got in advance, bring this down, the challenge about inflation that we were just talking about, bring it down to the level of kind of the average American.
Yeah.
What should they be worried about? What would they expect to be experiencing? Is it something an average person needs to worry about?
That's a great question because it's, you know, having inflation, right now inflation's running near zero year over year. But boy, that sounds like a good thing, right? Prices aren't growing. How can that be a bad thing? It's a bad thing because it's a sign of something bad in the economy. It's a sign that we're not using all our available resources in an effective fashion, that the demand that we have for goods and services is not sufficient to employ all the human talents we have available in our country. So if you're concerned about wanting to take use and advantage, that our country makes full use of its human resources, you should be concerned about that. And that's what having low inflation is a signal of. It's a sign that prices, because if we had enough demand to push against the supply of resources in our economy, we'd have wage pressures, which would be much more significant than we face right now. We've seen very subdued wage growth since the end of the recession in 2009. And that would translate at some point into price pressures as well. So I think the way you should be thinking about having inflation being low is that it's a sign of underemployment, of unemployment being too high and unemployment being too low. Now, how much is it? So how should you do that translation? I think it's very hard to know quantitatively exactly how to do it, but we've done some estimates of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and if you think of inflation right now, core inflation, which strips away food and energy, goods and services, that's a good thing to do if you really want to know what energy prices move around a lot, and you want to strip those away if you want to get something closer to the true underlying movement in inflation. That's really in the low, about a little bit under 1.5%, 1.3% right now. That sounds pretty close to 2. But it really is, when you translate that into unemployment space, it's more like 2 percentage points of unemployment. Well, that's a lot. And so that's a lot of underutilization of human talent that's going on in the United States right now. So that's what that's how I think about it from my point of view, how I motivate myself to care about the fact that inflation is running too low.
So the next question, probably good to remind everybody that no policy is being proclaimed from this podium tonight. But we talked about the 2018 inflation targets of 2%. When do you think interest rates are going to be raised?
Oh, wow.
So I'm repeating your disclaimer.
Yeah. I talked today about my own views on that. So the first thing is that we always get asked this, when do you expect interest rates to be raised? It's impossible for me to give a talk of any kind without that question being asked. But it's sort of the wrong question in the sense that it's really what conditions would lead me to favor interest rates being increased. That's really more what you should be asking me or thinking you want to know from me. I want to see my 1 to 2 year ahead outlook for inflation being back to 2%. So right now, my outlook for inflation is not going to get back to 2% until 2018. Well, that's a very long time. I would like to see us getting back to inflation, our inflation goal much more rapidly. And at 1 to 2 year ahead, why do I say that? That's the usual lag we think of monetary policy operating. So when I translate it, that those conditions for an interest rate increase into one other thing is I want to see these market-based measures of inflation expectations that I talked about earlier, the bets that people are putting on inflation, I want to see those going back to normal. They fell over the last 6 months to 8 months. I want to get those normalized. With that, so those are my own conditions. That leads me to think that we should be deferring an initial increase in the Fed funds rate target under my current outlook into the next calendar year, really into the second half of the next calendar year. So that's my view. Now, I'm not speaking for the committee, as I indicated earlier, and this is not the committee's perspective. Now, how do you know that that's not the committee's perspective? Every quarter, so every other meeting, the participants of the meeting will release their forecasts for how they think, how they would set interest rate policy if they were in charge. So we're each asked, all 17 of us are asked, what would you do with interest rates if you didn't have a committee? You were in charge of interest rates singularly. It is the counterfactual we're asked about. So of the 17 participants in the meeting, 15 of them said that they were in charge of interest rates, they would lift them off their current low level in 2015. So only two people said it would be after 2015. I'm not allowed to say that I was one of those two people. But you can make your own surmise about that. But 15 of the 17 said they wanted to see an interest rate increase in 2015.
Do you think there? Thank you. What long-term impact, if any, do you think might come from Congress's apparent unwillingness to invest in the infrastructure of the United States, kind of failing infrastructure, let's say? What long-term impacts are going to come if we don't kind of reinvest in our infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean here. So some of the context here. You know, I'm a maker of monetary policy. One of the great things about the United States is that we're those of us who make monetary policy. I'm not an elected official. I'm an appointed official. I'm given a tremendous amount. We all are on the Federal Open Market Committee given a tremendous amount of latitude by Congress to make monetary policy. There's conversations about restricting that, but that's right now we are given a tremendous amount of latitude. That's a very good thing. It's a lot of research has shown that you want monetary policy to be free of these short-term electoral pressures that politicians, quite according as they should be, given the electoral system we have, are very responsive to. You don't want monetary policy to be facing those same things. I give you this context because I'm very reluctant in general to make comments about fiscal policy. The deal is I don't say much about fiscal policy. They give us the latitude. The implicit deal is they give us a latitude to. I wouldn't put Congress in here. This is right now. I think that I would put this in terms of just an economic decision that interest rates are very low right now. That means that if you were running the U.S. government as a business, your opportunity cost of funds are very low, and just running it from a profit-making viewpoint, which you may or may not argue is the right viewpoint, boy, you might think that if you can borrow for 30 years at a 2.5% interest rate, which is what the U.S. government can do right now, there might be a lot of projects that are available for you to take advantage of. But but there's trade-offs always. You know, investing in that means you can't do other things, and so that's not my job to sort through that. That's Congress's job, but ultimately, it's all our jobs as voters to sort through that. Congress, there's this sense that Congress is somehow disconnected from the American populace. I never get that sense when I talk to people. I think some of the the challenges, the debates we hear in Congress with the president, I hear them when I talk to people as well. So.
And back to the back of the room.
We have one from the Twitterverse, very exciting. History has shown that extended periods of low rates has always led to a massive boom and bust. How is this time any different?
You know, these are tough questions to answer because it's sort of the premise. It's not my characterization of what I see in the economic data. So the two periods of very low interest rates that I'm familiar with are in the United States during the Great Depression, and essentially interest rates are kept near zero for very long period of time, probably close to a decade. You can only see that as having been a period of very subdued economic activity. Unemployment was in the double digits throughout that time frame. You know, we saw some very fast growth at time period during some of that the 1930s, but in general, I think that was an experience of just being a bust having followed a boom. Same in Japan. We have very low interest rates now. Again, they've been low for 20 years. Hard to see the boom in Japan that's taken place because of low interest rates. But what is true is that low interest rates are typically been a response to a protracted periods of low interest rates have followed booms. And I think that's a good question. Why is it that the busts that have taken place after booms like we had in the U.S. in the 20s and Japan in the 80s and in the 80s have led to such protracted periods of subdued economic activity that have led the central banks to adopt low interest rate policies. But very hard, I think, in the 30s in the United States or in the last 20 years in Japan to see it booms anywhere in sight. And I would say now, I don't see the dangerous boom being created by our low interest rate policy at all. I mean, employment remains very subdued and prices remain very subdued. You know, asset prices have risen gratifyingly, I think, since March of 2009. But really, if you normalize for GDP growth and for price growth, still remain relatively low.
What do you think about technologies like Bitcoin and their possible impact on global finance?
This is just an exciting time. I studied payments. This is the economics of how people pay for things as part of my research. And it was generally treated as a sort of boring stepchild of macro, and you know people didn't pay much attention to it. Now it's really exciting because of things like Bitcoin. So Bitcoin has two pieces to it. One is this private currency aspect. You know, I think that's something we continue to monitor the Federal Reserve, we're keeping track of. I think the technology aspect, that's really more interesting. And the use of the blockchain kind of record-keeping device, I don't know where that's going to go, but the development of something like that has been, I think is very interesting. More generally in payments, the speed of how people can make payments now, and I think the continuing evolution we see in both here in this country and other countries makes this a revolutionary time really in this area, and it's just a space we're going to continue to see change in the next 10 years. It could be very rapid.
Is it anything even within the realm of the Fed to?
This is something
affect
that,
or
well, I'm glad you asked that question actually, because I'm we recently released a paper called Strategies for Improving the U.S. Payment System. And essentially, we're embarking at the Federal Reserve System, really through our convening role of bringing together different players in the payment system, stakeholders in the payment system, I should say more broadly, not just players, but stakeholders in the payment system, to talk about the best way forward for U.S. payments in terms of how do we get more speed? How do we get more security? And there's a lot of different people have different views about how to achieve these objectives. We're trying to bring them together to find the best way path forward. Why are we doing that? Well, part of it, central banks are always involved in payments around the world, but we have a distinct operator role of the Federal Reserve. in terms of we clear checks, we run an ACH business, which is facilitates another form of retail payments, and interbank payment system, we run one of those as well, wholesale. So we have an operator role, which is very important for the organization. And though we also have this public policy role trying to facilitate change, lead to more security and more speed.
I mean, it raises an interesting question about sovereignty and control. If with technology, with Bitcoin, creating a world where governments would seem to have less influence over what's happening, is that just kind of an anomaly of this moment in history, or is there a trend in that?
No, I when I look at things like Bitcoin, I think about it more as just facilitating a faster form of payments. And I'm not as, you're emphasizing more, I think, the use of it as an alternative currency. I think of it just more as a technology which facilitates, and there, you know, Bitcoin gets a lot of press. There's other technologies being developed that also have these kinds of properties that are faster as well. And I think these are just things to keep watching, and we'll have to see how they unfold.
So let me ask you a question then about a currency with a little more of a track record. What are your opinions about a weak euro and its effect on the U.S. economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is just one of the channels through which monetary policy affects the economy more generally. You know, we talk about interest rates having a tighter monetary policy. And essentially, since the end of 2013 especially, but even before that, the Federal Reserve Committee have taken steps to attempt to tighten the stance of monetary policy. This has led to upward pressure on the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies. This means that is a drag on the U.S. economy to have have this appreciation of the dollar. That is how tighter monetary policy, one of the ways tighter monetary policy affects the economy. I think in general, it's good for us as Americans to have a strong European economy, strong Japanese economy. The rest of the world, having a strong rest of the world economy is really good for us. And whatever can be done to facilitate that is good.
Thanks. Any more?
Are we on? Yes. So you've talked a lot about inflation and the Fed's target of 2%. What does the Fed consider to be maximum employment in the current economic climate?
Yeah, this is a great question because there's a lot of uncertainties about it. We have an estimate of where the long-run unemployment rate will be. It's consistent with 2% inflation. At the last meeting in March, we all submitted forecasts for that. They were all, the low 5% range. Right now, unemployment pretty close to that, around 5.5%. And now it's the estimates of where we're going to be in the long run are between 5 and 5.2. But if you've tracked those, you keep track of those estimates over time, they've fallen steadily over time. My own estimate, if you go back 2 years or so, was over 6, and now is down near 5. And we have serious discussions at the staff level of lowering even further. Now, what's making us do that is, If we were really close to max employment, you would think we'd see more wage pressures than we do. You know, if we're going to be close to an unemployment rate, which is indicating that we're run out of bodies in terms of we're pushing up against max employment, you'd start to see more wage pressures, start to see more inflation than we're seeing right now. And so my own perspective is that I think we could have a lower unemployment rate than 5% consistent with 2% inflation. We're still thinking about that question in Minneapolis. But in terms of employment itself, I think the fraction of people people over the age of 16 have a job is 59.3%. I think that could be much higher, much closer to where we were in late 2006 without generating inflationary pressures. I don't know where exactly we could be, but I know we could be doing better than we currently are. So that's how I think about the policy. The reason it's so hard to forecast is long-run employment in the U.S. is shaped by a number of factors that frankly, are just outside the control of monetary policy. But we have to look at prices, we have to look at wages, we have to look at the path and pattern of employment data. And what I say when I look at that is we could be doing better than we're currently doing in terms of promoting maximum employment.
So I've got a question for the students out there. By a show of hands, how many of you are studying economics? Okay, good luck with money and banking. Narayana.
That's the kind of support economists love.
Don't come to me for tutoring. Yeah. Narayana, what advice do you have for our students out here who are interested in pursuing a career in economics?
You know, it's such a different field from when I entered it. It's become so much more empirical and data-oriented than it was when I was in school 30 years ago, or, you know, frankly, a little more than 30 years ago. And I just think that learning how to use statistical methods, learning how to use data, the more opportunities you have to get involved with, as an intern, with research opportunities to get yourself familiar with that, boy, you're going to be a better economist because of it, but you're just going to be a lot more, well, you'll have a lot more opportunities available to you of all kinds if you're able to do that. So I think it's been a huge transformation in our field. Is we had to rely purely on pretty much what I think of as deductive methods, assuming things about people's behavior and firms' behavior and then reaching conclusions. I think that's still a very powerful methodology, and I use it all the time myself, but we're able to supplement it and complement it in such effective ways by a range of data and a range of statistical methodologies that just were not available to us in the 80s. And I think getting yourself familiar with that as a college student is really, really helpful. And there's a certain amount of technical mathematical training which is useful to have, you know, some calculus. It's a little bit of a barrier to entry to the field. Get it over with, get on top of it, and you'll find it a useful tool thereafter. It is not where the interesting questions lie, but it is the language we use as economists to talk to each other. And so it is important to get that on the table. Those, I guess, would be my advice. The final advice for anybody, any student in the room, but even those of us who are older, is you know, when you're thinking about what you want to do with your life, do something that you really like. You're just going to be doing it a long time. You're going to spend a lot of hours on it. Your life is just going to be a lot happier if you choose something to do that you like. And I really counsel students, but, you know, as I say, all of us should follow that.
The refreshments are ready, and we are able to have a little more conversation informally with President Kocher Lakota over treats over here. So that concludes the formal part of our program. We're going to move over there and have refreshments. President Kocher Lakota is going to stick around a little bit longer. But for now, would you join me in thanking him for coming to Winona State University.
Thank you. Thanks for the questions.
Thanks, everybody.